the European Central Bank has been creating $35 billion a month of new credit for the Eurozone. Most of it, unfortunately, been going into banks, which then goes into the speculative economy, bonds, derivatives, and all sorts of other things. Social Credit's view is that that same facility can be used but go into the productive economy for building houses, for improving the facilities in our hospitals, for building railways and extending our railways, for building roads, sewage systems, and environmental protection.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
This is a repeat of a previous program.
I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM. And I'm afraid I have a case of laryngitis, so I won't quite sound my usual self, but I'm doing the best I can. Now, neoliberal economics, turned loose on New Zealand by Roger Douglas and Labour in 1985, and I may say, is still adhered to by both Labour and National today, has failed. The results speak for themselves. Hundreds sleeping on the streets, in cars, in sheds and garages. Hundreds more living in taxpayer-funded motel units because they have no homes. Full-time workers unable to afford their rent. A health system in crisis. Inequality at its highest level ever. Roads, sewage systems, water supply and other infrastructure in disrepair, our clean green country under threat. We need a new economic system that works for people and the country, not for a favoured few. Such a system exists. It's called social credit. It has been tried before in New Zealand and in other places and worked brilliantly. It's being increasingly talked about internationally, and it could work for us again. Today I have in the studio Chris Leach from the Social Credit Party. In fact, he's been elected leader very recently of the Social Credit Party. So welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Lisa. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. I'm terribly interested in alternative financial ideas for government because, of course, it's not going well at all. Can you tell us about when social credit ideas have been tried in New Zealand in the past?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And worked exceedingly well, I might say, as well. The first Labour government in 1935 that was elected then with Michael Joseph Savage as the Prime Minister and John A. Lee, who became the Secretary for Housing, actually campaigned on monetary reform. That was the centrepiece of the Labour Party's campaign in the 30s. And they instituted monetary reform, which is essentially using the ability of the Reserve Bank to provide finance for government expenditure, particularly on things like infrastructure. So in the period of the 12 years that Labour Party were in power, they used Reserve Bank finance at just 1% interest to build 40,000 state houses. Of course, 1935 was a time of great housing shortage, very much like what we're facing right now, particularly in Auckland, but across the country. And that finance from the Reserve Bank enabled them to build houses, provide employment for lots of people in the course of building houses, and of course homes for many people. Many of those homes are still standing today, and one of them, of course, was one that John Key was brought up in Christchurch, which was a house built under that scheme. The beauty of it is, of course, that the Reserve Bank was owned by the government, so the 1% interest that they paid actually circulated back to the government in profits from the Reserve Bank. So to all intents and purposes, it cost them nothing to build 40,000 state houses. That was incredibly successful. They went further than that, though. They established an overdraft facility at the Reserve Bank for the producer boards, so that, for instance, the Apple and Pear Marketing Board and the Dairy Board were able to pay the producers of produce immediately, and then repay the overdraft to the Reserve Bank once the product was sold overseas. And that was one of the key things that built up the strength of our dairy industry and also our apple and pear industry.
Well, I threw you right in the deep end there, but it just seemed an appropriate question. But to really understand that and understand about the Reserve Bank creating money, we have to really understand a little bit about money creation itself. Because perhaps not everybody understands how money used to be created and what it was then and how it's being created now.
Well, I can go into that a little bit. Just to give you an example, though, I think everybody has heard of the term quantitative easing. And that's being practiced by central banks across the world. European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, just to name a few. And quantitative easing is just a fancy way of a bit of new terminology, I guess, of saying that the central bank has the ability to create new credit. It doesn't actually create money. It's not dollars and cents. It's electronic money, which is what most of our money is these days, of course. People might realise perhaps that nearly 98% of the money that's in circulation is essentially digital money. The notes and coins that we use are only about 2% of our money supply. So the central banks have the ability to create new credit, and they do that to make sure that there's sufficient liquidity in the financial system, which is what quantitative easing has been. And for instance, the European Central Bank has been creating $35 billion a month of new credit for the Eurozone. Most of it, unfortunately, been going into banks, which then goes into the speculative economy, bonds, derivatives, and all sorts of other things. Social credit's view is that same facility can be used but go into the productive economy for building houses, for improving the facilities in our hospitals, for building railways and extending our railways, for building roads, sewage systems, and environmental protection. All of those things are building assets.
That's a much more logical way of using money. I find it very hard to understand why that isn't happening. I mean, it isn't logical. Why are governments not standing up and saying, this is how our money should be used?
Well, because we got tied into a particular system, and I think governments are finding it very hard to break out of that. One government that is doing that, incidentally, though, is Japan. And the Japanese government, for the last 7 or 8 years, have been sourcing very large percentage of the finance that they need direct from their central bank. And the central bank is one of the biggest holder of government bonds in Japan now. Of course, the advantage of that is that the enormous amount of interest that was being paid by the Japanese government to the private banks they were borrowing from is no longer being paid, and that money is being used by the government for the benefit of the citizens in Japan. So it's being used right now by Japan. China also do it, of course, to a substantial extent. But the Western nations have been stuck into the system of borrowing effectively money created out of thin air, or credit created out of thin air, by private banks rather than using the capacity of their central banks to do that.
And I think this is a very important point for listeners to understand, is that money is essentially created out of thin air by somebody going tip, tap, tip, tap on their computers. And there is the money. It's not something that's held in a vault somewhere.
No, it's not. I mean, the majority of people, I think, are bought up with this, what essentially is a myth, that person A deposits some money into a bank, and then the bank lends that money out to person B. And in fact, quite the reverse is the case, that it is the action of the banks lending money that they've created that gives people the ability to build things and do things and then have money to deposit back into their account in the bank. And this has been confirmed quite substantially in recent times by the Bank of England. If you log into the Bank of England's website, you'll see there's a video that explains exactly how banks create money. If you look at the German Central Bank, they've got an extended article on their website about how banks create money out of thin air. And even the New Zealand Reserve Bank, in a bulletin that they published a few years ago, goes into an explanation of how private banks create most of our money supply.
Well, I think TV3, I think it was, did a little clip on how money was created about 2 or 3 years ago. And I was blown away by the fact that there wasn't a sort of an outcry of people saying, no, this can't be true. Because when I tell people or I show them that clip, they say, surely not. You know, they're stuck with the idea that somewhere there's notes or gold.
Well, I think it's in the realms of, you know, if somebody said to you, look, there are people living on Mars right now, they look like us and they live lives very much like us, you'd go, oh, no, that's not possible, it couldn't possibly be. They'd also go, oh, really, that's interesting, and then immediately discount it as not being possible, because it's very hard to overcome a way of thinking that you have thought for all of your life. And we've been brought up, as I say, with this myth that somehow banks lend out money that other people have deposited with them. And I think the hardest thing for anybody to do is to look at what they have been brought up with and go, hang on, actually, maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's not quite the way I thought it was going to be.
Yes, I quite agree. And of course, you know, as children in New Zealand, you'd put your money in your ASB account and the bank would look after your money. So they have this nice, we're terribly kind looking after your money and we'll even give you a little bit of interest kind of feeling about banks. And that's not really how it is anymore.
Well, no, that's true. But I think one of the essential features of banking is that banks do need to attract deposits. They do need to have people depositing money with them, because it does affect, in the long run, the volume of new money that they can create. I mean, there isn't an unlimited capability to create new money. And it does have to be based on something. And so, therefore, the banks do need to have depositors' money coming into the bank so that they at least have something secure to then use as a base upon which they can create new money to lend out for mortgages and other purposes.
Well, you know, this is a really interesting discussion I'm having with you, because I don't think I could have it with any of the leaders of the other parties, because money is just sort of, the topic of money is kind of pushed aside. It's more about, have we got enough or to do this, that and the other. It's not actually about, can we think about new ways of creating it and new ways of doing it.
Well, I think it's more than that. There's no thought about where it actually comes from in the first place.
Yes.
As I say, we're brought up with this myth that somehow money gets put into a bank and gets loaned out to somebody else, and that in fact is not the way it happens at all. And I was just listening to Winston Peters on a radio interview on another station as I was driving in here today. And the question put to him was, well, are you serious that you can't find more money to pay the nurses? And he was saying, well, look, you know, there's only so much there, and it's just like a household. You know, you can only spend so much based on how much you've got coming in, and you can only borrow so much, because if you borrow too much and you need to go to the dentist and you haven't got any money to pay the dentist, then you can't afford to borrow anymore. And I thought, goodness me, Winston, you know, just stop and listen to yourself for a minute. Look at a little bit of history. Do some investigation into what really is going on. Mm-hmm. Now, what Winston needs to do is have a look at the amount of interest that the government is paying every year currently to the private banks on the money it's borrowed. And that's $4,500 million every year gets paid out in interest on borrowed money. That's money the government's borrowed from private banks who created it out of thin air. Now, how stupid is that? If the government was to source that borrowing from its own central bank, any interest it paid would come back to the government because the government owns the central bank anyway. So essentially, Winston could find $4.5 billion right now for the next 12 months to do things like paying more to the nurses, paying more to the doctors, building a whole lot of houses, building some infrastructure, doing something about environmental cleanup, putting more police on the beat, reducing class sizes. I mean, $4.5 billion every single year that's being paid out that is totally unnecessary. So my message to Winston is get real, take a look at what's really going on and stop giving us this rubbish about there's no more money to pay nurses.
Well, I totally agree. I mean, I was thinking more of the level that, well, you didn't need to buy 4 bombers for the airport, for the Air Force. But this is a much better solution.
Well, I mean, I think it is valuable to have that Air Force capability. I mean, we are a small country. We're in a vast sea of ocean. We've got an exclusive economic zone that needs to be patrolled. We're called on by the Pacific Island nations, particularly in terms of search and rescue, and we have to have that capability. Where there are major weather events, such as there have been on the islands over the past few years, we need the ability to respond to that. So that spending on those aeroplanes, in my view, is totally justified. The spending on interest on borrowed money created by private banks out of thin air is not justified.
Right, yes. Well, certainly, I mean, there's still the issue of, you know, you can decide how you're going to use money or what things you're going to do first. And I was just, you know, referring to the nurses being rather urgent.
Yes, the nurses are certainly rather urgent, but it's not a case of we have to stop buying search and rescue capable aeroplanes in order to pay the nurses, because we don't. What we have to stop doing is doing a stupid thing like renting our money from private banks when we actually have got the capability to produce it ourselves.
So if we look back at social credit history, there was a horrible label given in the time of Bruce Beetham that it was the funny money party, because people didn't understand the concept of social credit. And I think it's very important that people now understand the concept so that labels like that can't be used to discredit a party that has a lot of good ideas.
Well, of course, politics is about perceptions, isn't it? And those kind of labels get thrown around. And if they're said often enough by enough people, then they tend to stick. But you couldn't get anything funnier than the situation that we've got right now. And I think one of the things that is interesting about that is back in Bruce Beetham's time, there wasn't the international discussion about where money comes from and where it should come from and how it can be applied and how we could redesign an economic system that you have right now. I mean, there wasn't the situation where you had the Bank of England on its website with a video telling you about how money is created. You wasn't the situation where you have Adair Turner, who was the former chairman of the British Financial Services Authority, which was the regulator for the financial industry in the UK, going around the world as he is doing now, explaining about how money is created and talking about how we should use it, how central banks should create money and use it for building infrastructure, even to the extent, he's saying, of maybe even paying out essentially a national dividend or a country dividend to every citizen of the country, free of charge, small amount, so that they get some value for the economic production that's been going on in the country, and in that way stimulating the economy, giving people the ability to purchase the things that are being produced. Now, you couldn't get someone more orthodox financial than Adair Turner, who is now talking about these different concepts.
And that idea is a little bit like a universal basic income.
It is a little bit like a universal basic income. The difference with a dividend is that it wouldn't necessarily always be the same amount in each year, because the idea of a national dividend, which is also a social credit concept, is that it is based on the value of the production of the economy over a year, and that may vary from year to year. Whereas a universal basic income is basically a fixed amount, regardless of what the economy, the state of the economy is in any year.
Well, we already have a universal basic income in the form of the pension. But,
yes, we do.
But as more people become unemployed, as more jobs become technical, we're going to actually have to look at that as a concept, aren't we?
Well, yeah, we're going to have to look at it, and we're also going to have to look at some other concepts, which incidentally, social credit addressed itself to way back in the 70s. It produced a 13-page document called Industry and People. And back in the 70s, that document talks about the advance of computerised and robotic technology and its capability of displacing workers from traditional jobs. And so while a national dividend was one of the concepts that was canvassed in that document, there was also the concept of people becoming owners in the businesses that they worked in. So, for instance, if you work for a major corporation, then the government would give you the ability to buy shares in that corporation, so that you then became a part owner and you derived some of your income from the profits of that industry or that company that you worked in each year. So rather than all of those profits going off to shareholders who didn't have anything to do with the business other than sit back and take their profit, the actual people who worked in the business would have an incentive to make it work better, more efficiently, less waste, more environmentally friendly and so on, because they would be getting a dividend from that production. And then as they were gradually displaced from their jobs, they would still earn an income based on their ownership of the company. Whereas now they are just chess pieces in the game, and if they can be replaced by robotic technology that doesn't make mistakes, that's more efficient, that can work 24 hours a day, then workers are just out on the scrap heap. Under the social credit concept, they would be out of a job, but they wouldn't be out of an income.
That's a really interesting concept.
And that was back in the 1970s, and I think that's one of the problems that social credit has had through its entire history. The ideas that it's been talking about have been way, way before their time, in a way. Essentially, social credit itself as a concept is way before its time, but now is starting to become more relevant because of the way the economic system is worldwide. As I say, many, many people internationally, professors and economists talking about, well, in fact, even Bernard Hickey, who is a well-known economic commentator in New Zealand, in a radio interview just last week, was talking about how banks create money out of thin air. And the interviewer was quite incredulous, didn't understand that, and Bernard Hickey went on to explain exactly how it happens. So you have this situation where there are now people like him and others who are starting to talk about the reality of what happens. But, of course, social credit was talking about it back in 1953, way before its time. So we were way before our time with these concepts of a national dividend and worker shareholding in the industries that they worked in. We were way before our time, for instance, with proposing that New Zealand should become an anti-nuclear country, where we should stop the use of anything nuclear in terms of ship propulsion. We do use some nuclear in hospitals, of course, and that's important, but that anti-nuclear stance was proposed by social credit 12 years before the Labor government ever got around to doing anything about it. We were way ahead of our time in terms of promoting proportional representation as a voting system as well. We were talking about that back in 1969. And eventually, of course, we got MMP in the 90s. So with many of the things that we've been proposing, they've been so far ahead of their time that people haven't been able to understand them, but nonetheless, they have eventually come to pass.
Well, that's interesting, because I'm looking at what's happening with the Green Party at the moment, and most of their ideas, even though there's this concept that the Greens are a bit weird and funny, a lot of their ideas now are very, very mainstream ideas, so it's almost making them irrelevant. So it's like there's a space for a new third party in New Zealand, to come up and perhaps even replace the Greens, because their ideas now are accepted. I mean, most people understand about climate change and keeping the rivers nice and reducing plastic and all of the things that they're promoting. And yet some of the really green things, like, no, we don't want 1080, we've got to find another way to control pests, and we don't need fluoride in our water. We need to reduce the amount of sugar that people are having. And we don't want genetic engineering, because it's apart from anything else, it's a fantastic opportunity for New Zealand to be GE-free for selling our farming things. So, and you don't hear much talked about GE, even though the Greens actually are not promoting GE. I should get that correct. But those are things that are in your policies, aren't they?
Mm, yes, they are. And again, way before their time in terms of concepts. I mean, again, in 1973, we produced a 28-page document called You and Your Environment, which talked about many of those concepts. And a lot of the solutions proposed in that document are still very relevant today. And that's before there was a Green Party, way before the Values Party, of course, which was the forerunner of the Greens. And so, yes, there is a need for a continuing flow of new ideas, because otherwise we simply do the same old things that we've always done and we get the same old results, and you've only got to look outside your front door to see what those results are, and they're not particularly pleasant. The thing that has always disturbed me with the Greens is that while they picked up a lot of our ideas, and good on them for doing that, and have promoted some new ones, and good on them for doing that, they have never really addressed the concept of where the money is going to come from to do a lot of the things that they want to do. They're stuck into this old economic paradigm that you have to borrow money or tax people. And so we're seeing that now with things like petrol taxes coming in. We're seeing that now with carbon taxes being promoted and so on. Now, some of the Greens will say, oh yes, but that is part of helping to change people's perception about the things that they do. And I would accept there's a need to change people's perception, because we have to get a lot better at a lot of the things we do. But taxing people more, taking more money out of their pockets, reducing their standard of living, reducing their ability to be able to keep their families in a warm, dry house, reducing their ability to be able to put decent food on the table, is not actually advancing any of that green agenda. And the Greens needed to get hold of the concept of monetary reform, because that actually gives them a way to implement many of the things that they're wanting to do, whereas currently they only have tax or borrow as a way of getting the money to do those things. Russell Norman, give him credit, did have a little go at it.
He did.
But Russell's problem was that he didn't understand the whole concept of monetary reform and how the economic system works and where money comes from, so that when those proposals got dumped on by the orthodox economists and, of course, the National Labour Party, he didn't have the answers to be able to back up what his initial concept was. And I think that was a great shame. And, of course, the Greens have retreated from that because they didn't want to go through that same situation again. But they need to get wise. They need to start investigating monetary reform and getting to grips with it and really understanding it, because then they would have the capability to be able to answer a lot of those questions that are being raised.
They did have people coming forward to them with ideas, because, of course, I was involved with the Green Party, very much so, around 2007, 8, 9.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people, because I was involved with one of them, coming forward with new financial ideas, and they were not wanted to. They were just not wanted.
Yes, I know. And I took to a number of people who are in exactly that same situation as you, where they've tried to get the Greens to have a look at some of these concepts, and they've been fighting a losing battle to try and do that. And I think that's a great shame.
It is a great shame, but then it's going to be the ashes from which I think social credit can rise from, because they are struggling, I think, now, and particularly over this 1080 issue, which is going to get bigger.
Yes.
I mean, how on earth can we be predator-free by 2050, when people like me are not really very keen on killing rats.
In my
property.
Well, I accept that, but certainly using 1080 to do it and killing off a whole lot of our other wildlife and polluting our rivers and our land is certainly not the way to do it. There are better concepts being advanced about how we can deal with that predator population than using 1080.
And that's where the money should go, rather than dumping green pellets everywhere.
Absolutely. I was listening to a radio interview a couple of months ago with a couple of New Zealanders who are working outside of New Zealand who have researched a way, for instance, to make a population of, I can't remember what the animal was, but let's say stoats, get them to the point where they cannot continue to breed. And they were struggling to find enough investment to be able to develop that concept to a stage where it could actually have some widespread trials. And I looked at that and I thought, how crazy we are. We're spending all this money through the Conservation Department to dump tons of 1080 on our land when we could take a little bit of that money and funnel it to these guys and get a way of actually controlling our pest population. Through a method that doesn't involve poisoning our environment.
I think the one concern is that it might be genetic engineering, and the problem with genetic engineering is that you have to really look at where does that go. Yes. 20 years down the track.
Yeah, look, I absolutely agree. I'm 100% behind you with that. I'm certainly not a fan of genetic engineering, certainly not when it comes to GE crops and things like that. But these two guys, from the interview at least, were very aware of those issues. And from what I got, and I didn't have the opportunity to research it any further to any great extent, but from what I got, it wasn't genetic engineering in terms of the way that we think about that right now. And it seemed to me like their concept definitely needed some more investigation.
Well, that's exciting. I'd like to hear more about that.
If they could get the investment to be able to continue and complete their research, and that's the difficulty, and that's one of the things that frustrates me about New Zealand is that we're a nation of inventors and inventors of concepts. Let me give you an example. A firm invented a jetpack, a strap-on piece of equipment that had the ability for humans to transport themselves from one place to the other. A Hamilton company, I think, from memory. And it was world-leading technology. They couldn't attract the investment in New Zealand to be able to take that to production stage, so it's now been lost to New Zealand. And why couldn't we do that? I mean, why didn't our government look at that and go, here's some world-leading technology, we could produce it in New Zealand, we could provide employment for a whole lot of people, we could garner a very substantial sum of overseas funds from the selling of these things all around the world. Let's put some money into this company and give them the ability to produce that world-leading technology in New Zealand. No, we didn't do that. We let it go overseas.
I think that happens often. And also, I know of a company that's got a system where they can turn waste. I think it's into concrete and things like that.
Yes.
They haven't managed to get any investment to get it started. And they were going to do it in Hamilton, I believe.
Yes.
But then what happened was the waste companies that are making money currently kind of put the kibosh on it.
Yes.
And this is, the competition, even though it's better for New Zealand, of course, there's other people making money out of the other systems.
Well, of course, there are issues there, but what we should realise in terms of waste is that our overseas corporations have a stranglehold on our waste stream in New Zealand. And so why should we allow that to continue? Why should we allow ourselves to be dictated to by overseas corporations? And again, that was an issue where the government could have come along and said, okay, you guys, you've got this fantastic idea, let's have a look. Is it feasible? Have you done the research? Have you done the development on it? Yes, let's put some money into that and let's do it in a way that we make it unprofitable for these overseas corporations to continue business, because we can make sure that you get a waste stream that is at a much lower cost. Doesn't sound like, you know, like something that's too difficult to achieve to me.
No, not at all. I'm Lisa Eyre, and this is Green Planet FM, and I apologise for my laryngitis. I couldn't give the interview over to Tim Lynch because he's in Europe. So, I'm speaking with the leader of the Social Credit Party, Chris Leach. So, Chris, we've talked a lot about money creation and how the way money is created currently is not helping anybody but those benefiting from the neoliberal agenda of privatisation, etc., etc. So, what are some of the other policies that you'd like to share with us?
Gosh, it's difficult to know which one to pick, actually. There are so many. I think one that is particularly important is that we have long been in favour of the Swiss system of government, which is that the Swiss people have the ability to determine a lot of what goes on in their country through the idea of binding citizens-initiated referenda.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a policy that that Social Credit had way back in the 1960s. Now, while we have a situation in New Zealand, is a situation where you can have a referendum on an issue, and the government can totally ignore what the view of the voting population is when it comes to that referendum. Interestingly, we've had one binding referendum, which was the referendum over changing our flag, which most people didn't want to have a referendum or even have a discussion on, certainly didn't want $24 to $30 million spent on having that discussion. And yet, out of the kindness of his heart, our former Prime Minister said that we could have a referendum on that issue and that the result would be binding. Interestingly, he didn't want anything to do with other referendums that we might have either had or wanted, because essentially those were considered to be non-binding.
We were very keen to have a referendum on the TPPA at the time.
Absolutely, and so we should have as well. So, so Social Credit has long been in favour of binding citizens-initiated referenda. I mean, the government can use them as well, but there should be the ability for citizens to raise an issue, get enough signatures to trigger a referenda, and the results of that referendum should be binding on the government. Now, we'd go further than that even to a process called recall, where, again, citizens have the ability, through the referenda process, to recall any elected representative and essentially, if you like, put them on trial. Now, let me give you an example. For instance, if your local MP, before the election, as part of his election platform, said, when I go to Parliament, I'm going to vote this way on this issue and this way on that issue and this way on another issue, and then it turns out that they do exactly the opposite, then the citizens of that electorate would have the ability to say, no, that's not what we put you there for, that's not what you promised, so you need to come back and explain to us if are there justifiable reasons for you doing that, and if not, we will sack you. Now, of course, a substantial number of electors would have to be involved in that process, and it would have to be done by way of a referendum, but it gives people the ability to call their politicians to account, and currently we only have that once every 3 years.
Yes, I think it's very important that we could do that, yes.
Well, it's very important for the future of New Zealand as a country and for the future of our democracy that we have more people being involved in the democratic process rather than less. We're in a situation much like other European and Western countries where participation in the voting process is going down. You've only got to look at the number of people who vote in parliamentary elections and local body elections and hospital board elections and so on. And a lot of the reason for that is that people feel that they don't have the ability to have any influence. You know, their vote doesn't count anymore. So why be involved? Why bother voting? Because, you know, whatever I do is not going to make any difference. And so I think that is very dangerous for the future of our democracy. And so it's important that we somehow put in place some mechanisms that bring people back into that democratic process. And binding citizens initiated referenda would be one, because then at least people will say, look, if we get out and vote for this and this referenda wins, then we can have our point of view heard. And also the process of recall is part of that as well. We have to look at ways of strengthening participation in our democracy to the extent, for instance, that I believe we should be teaching civics in schools. We should be teaching people what is Parliament about. How does our democracy work? What do your local bodies do? What do the hospital boards do? We need to be ensuring that children understand how their democracy works, because most of them have no idea whatsoever.
And that's a really good idea, most definitely. And the other thing that I think is kind of missing is the idea of ethics,
yes,
or values, as we had a values party once. It's kind of missing. It needs to be somehow at the core of a political party. Do you have anything in social credit like that?
Yes, we do. Again, I'd have to say way ahead of our time in, as far as that kind of thinking is concerned. And we have, in our constitution, we have a series of what we call tenets. It's not tenants to do with housing, but tenets, which are the founding principles of the party that everything else is based on. All our policy is based on it. The way we actually go about organising the organisation is based on it. And those are particularly important. They're enshrined in the constitution. They haven't been changed since day one when the party was first formed. And I agree with you. Ethics is something that is sadly lacking in society generally today.
So what are some of the principles or the tenets?
Well, for instance, let's just quote one or two. That systems should be made for people, not the other way around, which is currently what we have.
Yes.
And so our view is that if any kind of system, whatever it is not working for people, is not providing benefit to the majority of people, then we either need to scrap it or reform it so that it does do that. And, of course, you know, the economic system is the classic example, isn't it? The economic system is not delivering for people. It's delivering for a very small percentage of people, but it's not delivering for the majority of people. And, you know, when you look at the number of people that we have out of housing, low-paying jobs, et cetera, that is obviously one system that needs to be radically reformed.
Right.
And that applies regardless of what the system is. Let me take another one. The taxation system, for example. We have GST at 15%, which is a major impost on people, particularly on lower incomes, because they spend the majority of the money that they get in order to live. So everything they do with the money that they earn involves 15% tax, 15% GST, whereas people on higher income levels don't have that same situation. So we would scrap GST altogether, get rid of it.
Right.
Replace it with a transactions tax, which is a very, very small percentage, less than 0.5% on every transaction out of every bank account. Now, immediately, that would solve the problem with the nurses going on strike, the teachers thinking about going on strike, public servants thinking about going on strike, because the value of their income would immediately increase, because they wouldn't be spending 15% GST on everything that they bought. So there wouldn't be the need for the wage increases that they're all demanding at the moment. It would benefit local businesses because they're competing with internet shopping from overseas, and I know the government's looked at trying to do something about that, but that's only affecting the very big businesses like Amazon that people buy from, and doesn't affect all the smaller suppliers that people buy from overseas. So if we got rid of GST, immediately our businesses in New Zealand, particularly our small businesses, would be on an even footing with businesses overseas. Be much more competitive. the imposition of the transactions tax of 0.5% would actually start to pull in taxation revenue from those areas of the economy that don't currently pay GST, such as the financial industry, those who play on the money markets who don't pay GST, those who play on the stock market, which is essentially just a glorified gambling casino, don't pay GST. And those people who are looking for a quick return on money through financial means, you know, there are derivatives, there are all sorts of other financial, fancy financial instruments that are being used, don't pay GST. Under a transactions tax, they would be paying that small 0.5% interest as well. Now, we could raise the equivalent of the amount of money that comes in from GST just by that 0.5% transaction tax on every transaction that takes place. What it would also do is significantly affect the behaviour of investors, because a lot of those trades on the money market and on the stock market are done on very, very small margins, but in big volume. And the 0.5% transactions tax that replaces GST would make a lot of those transactions unprofitable. So investors would be then starting to look at what they could invest in that produced them some profit, and they would have to look at things like productive investments rather than speculative ones. So our company, for instance, in Hamilton that produces the jetpack might have been able to attract some investors to be able to produce what they wanted to produce in New Zealand instead of having to farm it out overseas, because all of those people that do have money to invest would actually then, under this transaction tax system, be forced to look at putting their money into things that are productive rather than speculative.
That's a very good idea. You're quite sure that would happen?
That they would do that? Well, you know, what happens on the money markets, for instance? New Zealand is the 10th highest traded currency on the international money markets.
Really?
The amount that is spent on buying and selling of the New Zealand dollar is greater than the amount of money that we spend on trade and commerce every single day in New Zealand. Substantially more.
That's amazing.
It is amazing, and when you look at it, you get a substantial shock, I can tell you. And a lot of that trading is done digitally. So people don't do it, you know, Joe Bloggs down the road doesn't go, oh, I think I'll invest in the New Zealand dollar tomorrow. If you look at it internationally, there is an enormous warehouse in the UK full of computers, like an enormous warehouse. If you imagine Packet Save, the biggest Packet Save store you've ever been into, and imagine a building that size filled with computers. And those computers are speculating on small movements in international currency, including the New Zealand dollar. And when that computer says that it looks like there's going to be a trend of a very tiny movement, it may only be a portion of a cent in the dollar, they either buy or sell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's all done by computerized technology, and what benefit is it producing for anybody other than the people who own the technology? A lot of those trades, if you had a system of a transactions tax, every time they settled on those trades, in other words, they paid the money for them, then there would be a very small percentage of that taken in tax. And it would make a lot of those trades totally uneconomic.
Right.
And when you calculate the amounts of money that are involved in that speculative economy and work out how much a 0.5% transactions tax would bring in, and compare that to the amount that we bring in with GST, you could bring in exactly the same amount of money, give or take a few million dollars, but pretty much the same. And as I said earlier, it would make a lot of that speculative trading in stocks and shares and bonds and derivatives and all these other financial junk bonds that go on totally uneconomic. So people who've got money to invest would have to go, now, where's a company that's producing something of value that I can invest in as a long-term investment so that it has some benefit to New Zealanders?
That is a very good idea because, as you said before, we do have a lot of people coming up with fantastic ideas.
Yes, we
and
do.
And they can't get them out in New Zealand.
Yes. Yes, I mean, that was just one example of the jetpack, but there are numerous of them, and there have been over the years. And so many of those people are forced to either license out the invention or the technology to overseas producers. New Zealand benefits in a very, very tiny way in comparison to the amount of profit that's made by the overseas company that has licensed that technology. And we are doing ourselves serious harm as a country and as an economy because of that issue.
Chris, I met you at a place where we were giving submissions on the CPTPPA, which is the new version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Well, the new old version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the old version with a new name to make it sound better.
Yes. Social credits obviously don't support this. And, of course, Winston Peters is and the New Zealand First are going to be in trouble because they said they wouldn't support it, and now they have, which is not good for their party.
Well, it's not good for the country either, frankly. The TPPA is designed to be good for big international corporations. It's designed to do away with the individual legislation in various countries and standardise it all so that big corporations only have one set of rules to play by. And there is no advantage to any smaller country in getting involved in that kind of an agreement. Now, if the TPPA was a trade agreement, it would be quite different, but it's not. It's been called a trade agreement, but the number of clauses in it that are to do with things other than trade are substantially more than the ones that are to do with trade. And as people like Robert Reich, who's an internationally famed economist and commentator, has said, it's essentially about giving big corporations access to somebody else's country, somebody else's money, and somebody else's market to increase their profits. So so Winston's backflip on the TPPA is surprising given his professed concern for New Zealand, and especially given the name of his party, you know, New Zealand First. Now, the CTPPA is just the old TPPA agreement with a couple of side letters signed between various countries and packaged up in a new name to make it sound good. It is not of any benefit for New Zealand, and it certainly shouldn't be instituted without having wide participation from the public so that we know what's in it, and also having some agreement from the public. It shouldn't be up to a handful of politicians in Parliament to run this kind of agreement or ram it through without wide participation of the public in that decision-making process.
Exactly. I think it was something like 5 clauses out of 29 that are specifically about trade. You know, all the others are about quite concerning things that will limit the freedoms of New Zealanders in so that, you know, the corporations have preferential treatment. One of the concerns, of course, is natural health. And as a party, you promote natural health.
Well, we're certainly very, very supportive of complementary medicines, of things like alternative health care, provided that the practitioners are registered with a registered body of some kind, because I think there is a need to ensure that there are some standards that people can have some confidence in. But things like acupuncture, homeopathy, naturopathy, all of those and other forms of so-called complementary natural medicine, we are certainly very much in favour of, in the same way as we are, for instance, very supportive of Montessori schools in education, because, again, I come back to one of the tenets that we talked about a little earlier, which is systems being made for people, not people for systems. Currently, under the health system and the education system, we have a top-down design system, which everybody is supposed to fit into. Now, we're not all the same size square pegs being fitted into these round holes, and so we need to have those kind of alternatives. Alternative education systems, again, provided that that there are some guidelines and some standards. Alternative systems of medical care, provided there are some guidelines and some standards so that we can have confidence in them, we very much promote, because that is instituting systems that will work for people rather than the other way around.
And so how would you see the TPP affecting that?
Well, the TPP affects that in a substantial number of ways. It is going to close off opportunities for PharmEd to be able to access a range of different medicines at prices that New Zealanders can afford. It is going to put in place more control by corporations over the development of our country as a whole. So that means New Zealanders are going to be fitted into a corporate government system rather than one that we have some control over. It also is going to affect our ability to do things like even implement some of our monetary reform ideas, because a large part of the TPPA and the CTPPA is to do with financial services and the ability of countries to not have control over their own banking and economic systems, to throw those open to the vagaries of the market and the manipulation of big corporations.
I think that just about sums it up, really. It's a pretty horrendous agreement. And also, I hope that you have all enjoyed listening to Chris talking about alternative monetary system, which is really, really an interesting idea and, to my mind, an essential thing to happen in New Zealand. So, Chris, thank you so much for coming in today. And I do apologise about my croaky voice.
Lisa, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for the questions and the ability to talk about some very interesting concepts, concepts whose time is coming.
I believe that too. It's time for a change.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. That was Chris Leach, leader of the Social Credit Party, interviewed by me, Lisa Eyre, with not much voice. Social credit has been around since 1953. However, its time has come, and I think you will hear a lot more about it in the future. The website is simply socialcredit.nz. Socialcredit.nz.
Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies. But of 7.7 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say Kia Kaha and Haere Ra. This was a repeat of a previous program.